Welcome back, friends, nerds, librarians, and all you ilk. I know how much Melanie loves it when we say ilk.
Welcome back, Allie.
Welcome back, Sam.
It's been a little while.
It has been a little while, but we've got an absolutely great episode.
Mm-hmm.
And this was recorded a little while ago, so, you know, mea's culpas? Is that how you do it in plural?
Holidays, work, people get it, man.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
We do this out of the goodness of our hearts. but this is a really exciting one to bring you, because our friend Michael is back on the show.
Of course. So Michael Wynn, who we talked to, gosh, like probably in our first several episodes, maybe a little bit
later. Yeah, I feel like his original episode on like Indigenous librarianship and working at Weiwa at UBC was like episode 5 or 8 or something.
Yeah, it was a really long time ago. And we are so happy to inform you guys that he has really been able to continue with the amazing work that he was doing. So he's now at Washington State University as a librarian, basically helping to teach Indigenous communities how to create and, you know, describe and archive digitally their assets.
Yeah, and what's really great about the whole Mercadew project, which he talks about at length in our interview, is that it is teaching people, but it's also like a collaboration between information professionals and Indigenous communities, which is fantastic. It's not just give us your stuff and we'll digitize it. It's let's do this together in a way that makes sense to you.
Here are the tools. Now let's figure out how you can use them. It's like community outreach at its core, which is really exciting to talk about. It was a really invigorating conversation. And, of course, we start with Mind Grapes.
Yeah, of course, we have a little fun talking about what we're up to. And it's been a while since this interview, and I still haven't checked out The Expanse, which Michael recommends, so I've got to get on that.
Shameful.
All right. I guess we should do this one, huh?
I guess without further ado, let's just get this one started. I'm Allie Sullivan, and sour cream!
And I'm Sam Mills, and the taco's good out here.
The taco's good out here.
So, Allie, what's on your mind grapes this week?
Well, I think we would be, you know, remiss as a nerd podcast if we did not, you know, discuss the sort of late fall, early winter Christmas movie run things.
Ah, okay.
Right? So, saw Doctor Strange, didn't want to, but then the reviews were good, so whatever. And I liked it. I thought it was really cool. And then, you know, of course, saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which was also cute.
What did you think of that one?
It was cute. It was fine. I really liked some of the visuals and I quite liked some of the characters. I thought the storytelling was really weirdly done.
Mm.
But I mean, that's how Rowling does it. So.
Especially when she's setting up for 5 movies.
Yeah, you know, it very much feels that way. You know, it like the end felt like it was filmed after they figured out how many they were going to have to do, you know?
Mm.
Like, that whole, like, you know, it could have had a much better ending, but instead they were like, but now we have to set up the rest of the movies, so we're doing this thing. And I'm just like, ugh, that's dumb. But
which was apparently a top secret ending, and then like some kid who works in shelving at BPL, Jonathan, told me about it in the elevator like 2 weeks before the movie opened. So obviously, it wasn't a secret.
Yeah, no, I had heard about it before I saw the movie too.
I haven't really paid too much attention to it. I probably won't bother seeing it in theaters, but I've heard that it suffered from it's just a random mix between very childish and easy humor, and then extremely dark sub-themes as well.
Yeah.
And kind of like a big tonal conflict there.
Yeah, you do get some tonal whiplash for sure.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it, but I can definitely admit that like there's some dark stuff that if I was a kid, I'd be like, what did I just watch?
but yeah, I really liked some of the visuals. I liked looking at the creatures and, you know, all that stuff was, it was just kind of fun, really.
So that's not the one.
Did you like Doctor Strange at all?
I did. Yeah. I mean, I liked it. I liked it better than Ant-Man, which was a travesty.
Mm-hmm.
Sam will disagree with me there, but like,
well, I hate the existence of the Ant-Man movie because it should have been the Wasp movie, but as a movie it was a better movie than Doctor Strange.
I disagree 100%. Ant-Man is a dumpster fire of a film. Mm-hmm. In all ways, shapes, and forms. Doctor Strange was, you know, not quite a dumpster fire. Maybe like, you know, the campfire got a little out of control.
I mean, it was good, it was good casting. I will say that.
Okay. Even that, I don't know. Cumberbund is always such a weird guy, and I still don't buy his American accent. Like, it slips so bad sometimes, and... No, I did enjoy it, though. Like, I thought some of the visuals were cool. I thought that, you know, it was like, well, Inception did it first, and Inception kind of did it better.
And in a way that made at least a modicum of sense?
Yeah, like, I didn't... I guess I'm one of those people who I get kind of annoyed when they're just like, oh, it's magic. I'm like, cool, how does your magic work? And they're like, oh, it's just magic. And I'm like, yeah, cool, but why does it work that way?
Because meditation.
Because magic. But like, you know, like, spoiler alert, I suppose, like, you know, when the buildings are folding in on themselves and stuff, I'm just kind of like, but how does that help them? Mm-hmm. How does that make life easier?
Same. Michael, have you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen it. I've read all the spoilers. As a contrast, another film that I haven't seen, so I'm talking about all the things that I know, obviously. apparently, a movie coming out called Slate, as in Slate of Hand, that has a lot of the same kind of big story themes, but is much, much more interesting.
Oh, okay.
So, I think it's supposed to come out in April, and you might want to keep an eye out for that. It sounds, you know, sort of, again, successful or relatively successful, intelligent protagonist, and then gets, it's much more, person level, it's sort of street level as opposed to cosmic level. And it's not part of the Marvel or DC, what have you. So a bit of a counter to those, franchises at the moment. Anyway, it sounds promising. And that's one that I've, seen compared to Strange and Iron Man.
Like character wise.
Alternative. It's interesting. It's about, a young black man in LA. So very different entry point.
Yeah.
Probably much more interesting.
Yeah, a little less of seeing the same thing. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's kind of what I've been thinking about. I mean, I guess the other one that that I saw that's kind of the big movie this holiday season was Arrival.
Oh man.
Which
yeah.
was I don't really want to talk about it too much because I feel like even discussing it is a spoiler.
I agree.
But it was really, really good. It was a really beautiful movie. So, yeah.
I was talking to my brother about that movie, and he was saying he went with his wife, and then they had some friends with them, and one of his friends at the end was just like, oh, get it. That was stupid. And my brother's response to that, to me, I don't think he said this to his friend, was like, that's why you're single. was apparently his response. Because it was the kind of science fiction that does what good science fiction does, right? Where it's exploring, like, relationships and the human soul and all of these things.
Yeah, it is definitely one of those movies that I kind of... It was a bit of a slow burn for me. Like, I saw it and I liked it. But I had to think about it for a few days before I realized how really good it was, you know? Mm. And, yeah, I don't know. Just thinking of movies where people are like, I don't get it. I have, my family is a lot like that. I made them watch Mad Max with me and my brother didn't get it. Aww. So yeah, well, but what about you, Michael? What have you been up to?
So I've been sort of, I don't tend to read much when I'm not traveling and I travel a fair bit for work. So I guess I get to read a fair bit. So I made the extremely poor decision of working on The Expanse book series. It's also currently a TV series, but they're massive, which is why I say it's a poor choice. I quite enjoy them. It's quite good sci-fi, and I enjoy that when I'm traveling. I'm on book two, and I think they just announced there's a seventh coming out, and these are just huge, huge books, but excellent, big sort of space world-building.
So, like, what's the setup?
Setup of sort of the first one that's flowing into the second is, you have sort of Earth and Mars and then the outer planets as the three big political groups. So people who have ties to Earth, then to the Martian Navy, and then sort of all the smaller colonies and asteroid colonies further out. And it's very much about the political tension amongst them. And then there's a large-ish instigating event that sort of kicks off the sort of the start of a big inter-human colony war. And it's all humans at this point. It's not a lot of alien stuff. Yeah, and it's about, you know, the crew of whatever one ship that is trying to do the right thing and they seem to be attempting to prevent the upcoming war and conflict, but they kind of just make it worse most of the time. But it's somewhat rompy, but sufficiently serious and good world building. So that's been my book read, and at the moment I've been binging on The Great British Bake Off for TV.
I know so many people who are obsessed with that.
I don't get it. Yeah. I don't understand.
Explain to us.
Have you watched it?
No.
No.
Okay, so, I mean, it's your standard multi-week elimination series baking or cooking. Well, it's a baking show, but baking or cooking show. The difference is that they're all delightful and they're very British and they're supportive of each other. And yeah, it's just it's the same events. They have competitions. Some people fail. Some people get eliminated. But the social dynamic is very different.
Okay, you just helped me understand why in 2016, particularly, I've been hearing so many people go bananas for that show. It sounds lovely.
Oh yeah, it's charming and it's quite calming to watch. I mean, the first season that we watched, there's a bread challenge, one of these is about bread specifically. And a large part of making bread is letting it rise, letting it proof. So they have like extended footage of them just like sitting around on their stools in the tent waiting for the bread to rise. It's just extremely quiet and British. But people who are very passionate about what they do, and they're all home bakers. So no professionals. It's just lovely and kind of relaxing at this time of year.
So where do you actually find Great British Bake Off?
YouTube. Like where? All on YouTube, I think, right now.
Oh, it's all on YouTube? Okay. Because we don't have it on Canadian Netflix is our issue.
Yeah, there was one season on US Netflix, which we watched initially, but it appears to be like really, it looks legitimate on on YouTube. It looks like it's
good enough.
Yep. So that's where I've been going for that at the moment.
Okay, I get it now.
So have you gotten any like good recipes, or is it just like a meditation?
Yeah, mostly I'd go with more meditative. I don't bake a lot for one. They don't really focus on or share the recipes all that much, and a lot of it is like, again, going back, I watched a bread episode last night, and it's like making just like a standard loaf, and it's very technical. So it's like just it's the technical challenge. It's not about a really exciting, interesting recipe. It's like, how do you do like make a nice roll or a nice bun? How do you do that properly? Okay. So.
And what do they get if they win?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure there's any stated prize.
Oh.
I think they're just doing it because...
It really does sound like meditation.
That's funny. Because, you know, normally you think of these, like, you know, competitive cooking shows, and there's got to be some kind of carrot at the end of that stick, right? Like...
The pride in a job well done. Oh, and I've heard things about Mary. I guess they get praise from Mary, right?
So yeah, there's the two judges all throughout. One of them is Mary Berry, cookbook author. So she's again just very an older British lady who's very supportive of them, and I don't know, it's interesting.
That sounds lovely.
Oh, and there's lots of puns. The two hosts are full of puns and British innuendo, and it's charming.
It sounds like it's probably comforting for the British this year as well as the rest of us.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Oh, man. That's great. I'm glad you're getting some relaxing TV viewing in.
Oh, yeah.
What about you, Sam? Have you been up to anything particularly fun?
I have indeed, actually. So as some people will know because they've probably been here for it. We've been running a sci-fi movie club over the last, like, I guess 4 or 5 months. Like, once a month, everyone comes over and piles in, and we pick a random sci-fi movie. Well, we pick, what was the system we came up with? We pick a random 5 from a list that we've built together.
And yeah, so there was there's a Google sheet and like a Google form where you can put in suggested movies.
And then of those 5, there's a Facebook poll, and then people vote. And sometimes it's very surprising, as in when the original Terminator was on the list, but then everyone voted for Dune instead. And then everyone abandoned...
Because Dune is a great movie and Terminator is stupid.
And then everyone abandoned me, Sarah, and Chris, who had never seen Dune before, to watch it together. And that was really entertaining. But anyway, because this year is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, I invited people who are coming to these sci-fi movie clubs to come on a sci-fi movie club road trip, because the Museum of Pop Culture, formerly the EMP in Seattle, has a big Star Trek 50th anniversary exhibit on right now. So we went to do that yesterday, and it was amazing. Just really beautifully put together.
So what kind of things do they have at the exhibit?
So what's neat is, so you pay an extra $5 with your admission, and that gets you into this like separate area that they've set up on 2 of the floors of the Star Trek stuff. And when you walk in, the like docent who's there to greet you reminds you that all of the stuff that you're going to see upstairs is all the original stuff from the shows, and that your admission only gets you in once. So like, do everything. Of course, Kat and I, being the biggest Trekkies on the trip, spent an extra half hour in there after everyone else was like, we're bored, we're going to go to the horror exhibit. But it was really wonderful, like really nicely curated. It's sort of, you go in up these stairs that have the, like, you know, where no man has gone before thing written on them, into this area that has sort of like the original script for The Cage, which was the unaired pilot, and some biographical information on Gene Roddenberry and his philosophy of, you know, in the future we'll all be able to get along and celebrate our differences. And his son donated his pilot's bars from the Navy, so those are there to greet you right away, so it sort of sets the tone. Mm-hmm. And then they've just got a ton of, like, the original costumes in there. And that was really, really cool to see. They've got some stuff that's so old that even with, like, careful restoration on the part of the folks at the museum, it's still in pretty rough shape. Like, by TV standards, you know, a cardboard model of what the deck of the Enterprise that the bridge is part of looks like. It was just not meant to last for 50 years, right? I mean, they didn't even know if they were going to last a year. And so one of the really interesting things about it is you see some of the early stuff up close, especially the costumes, and they kind of look like garbage. But, like, that's part of the magic of seeing these things, is, like, they had so little money, and no one had done before what they were trying to do on the scale they were trying to do it on TV. And so you look at, you know, like, Kirk's golden glittery sash outfit from, like, the Mirror Universe episode, and it looks like somebody sewed it in 5 minutes with, like, stuff from the scrap bin.
Yeah, they probably did.
But it's amazing because they did that and they used it to transport people to this whole other world, right?
Yeah.
And some of the newer stuff obviously looks a lot, like, better because they had more money and more time. I had watched a documentary on the History Channel before we went about Brooks Peck, who's the head curator there. And one of the things he had talked about was the navigation and weapons panel that Sulu and Chekhov sat at in the original series. When he tracked it down, it was in, like, a storage locker in a back lot, and it had a bunch of holes poked in it, and, like, it looked like it had been singed on one side, and it was just, like, in the worst shape. And so you get to see in this exhibit that panel sort of restored really lovingly by the folks at the museum, and it was really wonderful.
They did a similar Battlestar Galactica retrospective a couple years back that I went down and saw at at EXP, and they do a very good job with those exhibits in general, I find.
Yeah, the attention to detail on this one was like something else. Like everything you were seeing was not only the real stuff, but it was arranged in ways that made sense to you as a fan. And they had little touches like there were tribbles everywhere. And you could go up to the like sort of catwalk area and look down at the tops of the exhibits on the bottom floor, and you could see tribbles just like stuck in random places. Like they were slowly taking over. And what was neat was that like the stuff was really cool and the curation and the description of it was really cool, but they also had some interactive things. So there's a booth where you can scream Khan along with Kirk. And there were a lot of like video exhibits that explored different themes from the series. So Kat and I did one where you put on the headphones and you like choose a scenario on the screen and it's like, okay, we're going to talk to you about like robots and whether they're sentient. Like, what is your initial thought about this? Do you think that they're slaves or do you think that they deserve rights? And you kind of give your initial like opinion. And then it goes through clips from episodes from the different series where the characters themselves are arguing about this. And it asks you questions as you go through. And then at the end, it shows you like how your opinion of these ethical dilemmas stacks up against like other people who've taken the little interactive thing. It was really neat.
Huh. Yeah. That's interesting.
So they tried to make it a little more than just the stuff. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of Star Trek, are you optimistic, cautiously or otherwise, for Discovery?
I was. And then Brian Fuller quit.
Yeah, that was not ideal news, eh?
Yeah.
No. But then they did just release some casting news that's heartening.
I guess.
It's well, like, as the person who's like, Rent is the best musical ever, you should be happy that Anthony Rapp is going to be on it.
But like I like Star Trek a lot more than I like Rent, so it's not, I don't know. The Brian Fuller thing is discouraging. The CBS All Access thing is discouraging, and the way the CBS executives
That's weird.
Have been talking about how they don't think science fiction works on television. Like it's just all so strange. And like to be in that space yesterday with all of these people of all ages who were like crawling through the Model Jeffries tube and like looking at Data's painting of Spot and like talking to each other about like ethical dilemmas. And you're like, what do you mean this doesn't work? Like it's worked for 50 years. Like, and it's not a good attitude to hear from the people who are bankrolling it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they just need to, CBS just needs to let go of the property is what I think needs to happen. Like, they just need to give it to someone who's going to do it right.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. I don't know who that would be, though, is the problem.
I feel like, you know, FX might do a good job. Like, if they, like, take it off the network. Like, the network channels are just, they're going garbage anyway. Like, nothing good has come out of a network in the past, like, 5 years, I could argue.
Hannibal,
Joe says.
And actually, I would argue...
Keep my gallery over here.
This particular season, I would argue that Timeless is actually a really excellent science fiction show so far. And it's on NBC, of all places.
I feel like NBC has a little bit more cred, though. Like, NBC does really good comedies.
Yeah, and I mean, they did do the original Star Trek and then turned down the opportunity to do the new one. So I don't know. I just, what yesterday made me feel more than anything was that I wanted to dive back into some of the earlier stuff that I haven't watched since I was a kid. Like I watched a couple of more TOS episodes today. And one of the really neat things I picked up at the gift shop was a little model of the Galileo shuttle from the original series that is officially licensed by Trivial Pursuit and has Trivial Pursuit quiz cards in it. And like, I actually own a good Star Trek quiz game now, which is really hard to find. Star Trek Scenic, which I also own, is total garbage. So
yeah, that's a bad game.
It kind of made me want to like, just sort of immerse myself again in all the things that have come before now. But it was nice. They had a lot of like sort of videos going in different places, interviews with creators and one of the things that, like, Ron Moore, of all people, who kind of abandoned Star Trek after Deep Space Nine and did Galactica in part because he wanted to do something that was the opposite of Star Trek, he said this really hopeful thing about how, like, you know, sometimes it'll be good and sometimes it won't and sometimes it'll stop for a while, but I firmly believe that in 100 years there will still be Star Trek in some form. Hmm. And it was really nice. Oh, and a really nice touch, like, curatorially, speaking of all of the things we love about Star Trek, was at the very beginning of the exhibit, I'm just looking at my pictures here, they had this sign about the mannequins. And they said that usually they want their mannequins to be very nondescript and fade into the background and just display the costumes and outfits. But because of Star Trek and its philosophy and its sort of leading edgeness when it came to diversity on television, they decided to make sure that they had this gallery of very diverse looking mannequins that matched the, you know, skin tones of the actors where it was appropriate, or that just sort of represented a diversity of costumes as opposed to just all blank white mannequins. So it was a nice touch too.
That is really interesting.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping they would have a book of the exhibit because they had written some really interesting things, but nothing. But they did have that 50 years, 50 artists book that's been going around where all these different art pieces were commissioned. So I bought that and it's got some cool stuff in it. But yeah, if you're...
Well, so go ahead. How long is that on?
It's on till February.
Okay.
And there was a History Channel documentary, I don't know what it was called, something about 50 years, that aired like right around September when the actual anniversary was. And if you can't make it to the museum itself, I highly recommend watching the documentary because part of what it does is follow Brooks Peck as he's like negotiating with like independently wealthy collectors to lend him their phaser that they picked up at an auction and like restoring the control panels and designing the exhibit. And it's really neat. So that if you can't great. Make it there, that's a cool thing to watch instead for sure.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like we're all having some good stuff. Nothing bad this week.
Maybe we just all chose judiciously what to talk about.
Maybe. I've been pretty quick these days if something's not satisfying. So
curse of being busy, right?
So we, of course, have a return guest this week, the wonderful friend of the podcast, Michael Wynn. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always nice.
Yeah, nice to hear your voice.
So we have you on to do kind of a Class Z, sort of another one of these where are they now kind of things. Because a lot of our, you know, incredible friends that we made during grad school have gone on to do really amazing things and have really amazing careers that they're getting started. So we'd love to talk to you again about sort of what you've been up to since. To remind people if they haven't listened to us for long, this is sort of a follow-up we'll get the episode number in here somewhere. But as a student librarian, you worked at the Wee-Waa Library in at UBC, which is the First Nations Library. So your work is kind of a continuation of that idea, yeah?
Yeah, very much so. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so where are you?
So I'm at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, down in the southeast corner of the state. I'm the digital applications librarian, and I work specifically, well, my position is actually split between the library systems department and the Center for Digital Scholarship and Curation. I'll probably call it the CDSC just because I'm lazy, which is an interdepartmental collaboration. We have staff from library, from the English department, and more specifically within the English department, there's a digital technology and culture program, and a few other departments on hand as well. So we have a range of staff within our little cohort there.
Hmm. So what are some of the like big projects that you've been on since you started there? Because you've been there for a year?
Year and a half. Yeah. I started July last year.
Hmm.
So our department above all works with a lot of principles around ethical curation. So not project specific, but we're a classroom space that instructors and professors can book and use. We host events. A few months back, we hosted a Black Lives Matter symposium where we had some really fantastic speakers from around the country, and actually I think one or two from Canada as well, come in and did a day long symposium on the Black Lives Matter movement. But more specifically, what I'm involved with, the bulk of my role is working with Mukadu CMS. That's an Indigenous-focused content management system that's developed through our department at the library. I'm the main support contact for that software. So I do train, provide resources, support articles. That's the biggest chunk of what I do. We have a number of other projects related to that. One of those is the Plateau People's Web Portal, and this is kind of where I've been doing a lot of work the last month or so, specifically, which is why it comes to mind. And that's a collaborative platform. It's built on Mukadu. We run it through the university, and it provides access to materials held at our university, at some other local institutions, and some national institutions. So we have buy-in from Smithsonian Library of Congress. And what that is it's a platform for providing access to Plateau tribes cultural materials. The university has a memorandum of understanding with 11 Plateau tribes. And this portal was set up by request of our tribal representatives. So that's sort of big project number two. And then the other, I'd say, most significant one that we're doing in our department at the moment is the Tribal Stewardship Cohort Program. I'm only tangentially related to that. Primarily one of my coworkers runs that, and we're currently on the second cohort, and that is bringing in representatives from tribes around the country, so six tribes at a time, two staff members from each. They may be coming from their museum or library or cultural heritage department or something in that vein, and they're with us for a year as a cohort, and they receive training in sort of a crash course in a lot of library archival museum work, and then also the large focus on digitization, digital preservation, and then also through it they get a Mukadu site at the end of it. So I support that as well.
Wow, that's fantastic.
The three big things. Yeah, it's a really, really brilliant program.
Like, it's so great that the final one is in there, in the sense of, like, it's not just that you're providing the platforms and that you're doing the collecting and curating yourself, but you're actually providing training and access so that people can build their own.
Yeah, and I think the cohort program is a lot of the heart of our department. And sort of the basic format for that is we are six tribes. They come to us four times over the course of the year for a week at a time. So we're with them, all of them, for a full week. Sort of doing hands-on group training. It's a fairly intensive week, and then there's additional training, resources, and follow-up all throughout. So there's training in archival work, in, you know, collections assessment and accessioning, lots focusing on writing policy and procedural documents, hands-on training in digitization, digital preservation. We also spend time with them to work on their specific needs at their institution to ensure that they, you know, the support to develop their infrastructure further, and then at the end there's also a fairly large chunk of focus on writing so that they're able to continue to fund the work that they need to do individually.
Wow, that's great. Do you find yourself drawing on, like, your experiences from library school as you're creating this sort of crash course program?
So again, I'm tangentially related.
Okay, yeah.
I do the majority the MOOC training for that, but I also do a lot of or some of the audiovisual work as well. So in a sense, yes. What you probably remember from the first time I was on a couple years back, I was doing some work with the digitization program at UBC, and that has proven absolutely essential to the work that I'm doing with the cohort program. I tend to run the audio cassette digitization portion of the training that we do. So in that sense, yes. More generally, my position is very much that of a non-traditional librarian. I'm not, I don't want to say I don't do library work, because I do library work. but not what people recognize, as library studies for sure.
Yes, you're not like on the reference desk or, doing anything like that.
No, Yeah, I have relatively little contact with our students and faculty. Those who come and use our department as part of their classes, I do work with, but a little bit sequestered from just the general user base of the library.
So I have some questions about the CMS that you're working on. Mm-hmm. So that's like a content management system, right?
Correct.
So what makes that system unique? Why does it need to be developed on its own as opposed to, say, just adapting an out-of-the-box CMS from somebody else?
Sure. So there's a lot of things, but the really sort of the biggest critical feature is the concept of appropriate access to materials, which is obviously something that a lot of people think about. Let me step back, and I'm just going to really briefly touch on a bit of the development history of it, because I think it will help explain.
Yeah, awesome.
So the very first version of it was developed by the project director, Dr. Kim Kristen. She was doing work in Australia with the Warramungu community in Tennant Creek. And short version of that story is there was a collection of photos that the community wanted to share with community members. They wanted to be able to disseminate them digitally, so they were going to be scanned. And then share digitally, but there was a number of access restrictions that they had to place on certain photos. So within that community, within the Warramungu community, there's men's business and women's business. So there's some materials that only men or women would be able to access. There's family restricted content. There's also, they call it that, country restricted. So where geographically your family is from. And then they also have additional restrictions around, a number of parameters, but one being that, you know, they don't view photos of people who have passed. So there's a number of these face-to-face cultural values that exist in every community, whether it's an Indigenous community or not. We all have these cultural values, but they needed some way to have those in a digital format. When Kim was working on the first project, initially she's like, well, sure, that shouldn't be too hard. I'm sure we can, you know, buy something and make it work. Fast forward over a decade later, and we have a full custom system, because there aren't really any other platforms out there that focus on community values, community access, and again those cultural protocols which we work very closely with. So that was sort of version one, and until relatively recently, that's been completely offline. It was only accessible in their community center, and that's how they wanted it. They didn't want online access, but they wanted digital access and digital preservation of the materials.
Okay.
A number of years later, around 2008, as I mentioned earlier, our university has a MOU with 11 tribes, and that the Native American Advisory Board to the president basically said the university and other institutions have material that is relevant to us, is stuff that we've produced over generations. It's publications that are about our cultures, and we would like a way to access them. We would like a way to access them digitally and remotely, because we have community members who cannot get to the university. And also we want a way to be able to add to the records, because very often the information we have at institutions, such as the university or the museums, is incomplete or problematic or incorrect, depending exactly on what it is. So When that request was made to the university, our project director, again, Kim, was approached and said, well, we know about this other software that you worked with. Could we use that as the basis for what's become the Plateau People's Web Portal? The short answer was yes. So that drove the sort of next big development cycle in adding new features and new functions to the software. That launched in 2009. And then it's been ongoing development ever since. So we launched the latest version of the software, the 2.0 version, mid-late last year. And currently we're on, I think, 2.0.6. We launched a couple weeks ago with the addition of some new features there.
So, like, how does the process work in terms of determining what the access and description fields will be, and like how people from those communities actually submit information? Like, is it mostly user controlled or?
Sure. So it's going to depend on the, so I should also note, Mukidu, it's open source software. So anybody can take it and work with it. There's folks using it all around the world. And like I said, I did the support and training for it. So I get to have calls with folks all over Australia, New Zealand,
wow.
In the last couple of weeks, Greenland, Switzerland, all over the place. So, it's becoming a fairly widely used software. So it varies by project, as far as where the content comes from, how it's added, how it's accessed. And obviously whether it's a community level project, we have one community working with it, or a larger one like our Plateau Portal, which is collaborative. I mean, there's eight tribes and I think a half dozen institutions all being able to contribute content to it. So it varies. And the Plateau Portal is an example. Mm. It really starts with the people. So as much as possible, we work to get, and this, most of this took place before I came on, onto the university and onto the project. But they work to get representatives from each of the tribes into the institutions, into the collection spaces, working with the archivists or the librarians to identify content. So the selection process was very much a conversation and it still is going forward. So, you know, we do our best to say, well, we have found material that we think is relevant. Do you want this digitized and out of the portal? Do you not want it? Can you help us refine our search terms so that we can, you know, more accurately find content? Because very often, you know, there's historical issues that have been made. It's like, well, you know, I mean, an example, lots of tribes are often misidentified in historical materials. So mm-hmm. some folks, again, folks within the community have a much better, who have done research, have a much better grasp of, well, you're not going to find anything if you search for, Colville language. You're probably also going to have to search for Salish and this and that, because that's how people have misclassified our materials. So the physical selection process for the portal was very much a back and forth. And again, we're continually adding more collections, but nothing, all of the content in that portal was requested by tribal representatives. We have not added anything because we think it should be there. It's all been by request. And that's very much the case going forward. And one thing with the portal also is, so we've added material over the last decade or so. We're continuing to add new material in conjunction with the tribes, but they can also add their own content. We don't gatekeep who can upload materials to it. They can choose whether they're uploading content to be shared publicly or only internally or whatever other access restrictions are required. So we're really just providing the platform and the tool and some content, and then everybody's working with it in their own capacities.
That sounds like such a great example of the kind of like community-led principles that so many people in the library world talk about, but sometimes find it hard to actually execute. Like, it sounds like you really are providing the tools and the resources, but allowing the process to be led externally. That's great.
Yeah, we're certainly doing what we can. I mean, I wouldn't say it's perfect, but I think it is a good model. Very much in the last sort of month and a half is I've been conducting site visits to each of our participating tribes. We updated the software a number of months ago, so we're just now making sure that everybody who's working on the project is up to date on the software. So I've been traveling out and visiting everybody on site and doing some work with them. So I'm out traveling somewhere in either Washington, Oregon, Idaho, or Montana every week at this point.
Wow.
Which is quite interesting.
So that's the Mercadew project. And then what was the second one that you had mentioned?
So that one was kind of an overlap of Mukadu and the Plateau People's Web Portal.
Mm-hmm.
Since the portal is built on Mukadu, it's often a really good example, especially with Mukadu being open source. Lots of people are working with it, but I don't know about it.
Yeah.
I hear from people either if they're interested and want some more information or if they're using it and have a problem.
Right.
that's often when they come to me.
I feel like the same thing happens for another CMS that I'm going to be working with a lot more soon is the Islandora platform. And yeah, I went to an Islandora camp and they were very much like, we think this many people are using it, but there's probably a lot more.
And I'm glad, funny that you mentioned Islandora. So Islandora is a Drupal-based platform, as is Mukadu. And sort of circling back to Mukadu a little bit. So Mukadu is an access tool, or it's an access layer. It's only part of, or sort of intended to be used as part of a broader digital preservation plan.
Okay.
So it's very much uploading access copies. So your sure. JPEGs, not your TIFFs, your MP3s, not your WAV files, for a number of reasons. So it's very much built as an access tool and a community engagement tool. One thing, since it is open source and it is built on an established framework, we're hoping to work sort of on the development side. We're hoping to make connections with more people who work with software such as Islandora, which is a digital preservation tool or has those aspects to it, and look at ways to leverage that and maybe build, you know, ways to build in connections between those kinds of software so that we don't have to, you know, completely rewrite the book on Mukadu and you know, make it a digital preservation tool, which we want it to have some of those capacities, but it is very much built as an access tool. But maybe we can work with, you know, people who have Islandora experience to build those crosswalks, to build those connections between those kind of platforms.
Yeah, Islandora has a little bit of the digital preservation, but if you wanted to get really into the digital preservation, you'd want to talk to people from, I think in the States, they use a lot of ArchivesSpace. So the people who use DSpace use ArchivesSpace, or even Archivematica, which is a much more prevalent one up here.
Islandora can definitely...
The nice thing about Islandora...
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, like, at VPL, we're now using it for basically an institutional repository, a community repository, but...
Yeah, Islandora is nice in this case because it's also Drupal-based.
Yes.
So, you know, it's one step closer, but... And that's one of the nice things. So we have developers in-house at the university who work on Mukadu. So that gives us a fair bit of flexibility. We do also contract out some of the larger development cycles as we go through them. But we do have dedicated staff on hand who work with it. So that gives us a fair bit of flexibility for doing that kind of troubleshooting and ongoing development.
See, that's really nice. Yeah, having access to developers is one of the things that, like, as a community college librarian, I'm extremely jealous. because we don't have developers on our team. But we end up getting a lot of that sort of contact through a lot of our consortia and things like that. So
yeah.
It's there, but they're helping more people than just us.
For sure.
So this is, like we said, like you've only been a couple of years out of school. Is there anything that you really wish you would have learned in library school, or are you feeling like it pretty well prepared you for what you've had to face?
Oh, so that's always a fun question. it's
Sorry.
Tough because
for all of us.
You never know what you're gonna face, right? I mean, if I look specifically at where I am now, I wish I had done some more of the technical work. I wish I'd done a little bit more database and some coding and maybe some, you know, outside of the department resources on the sort of specific level. But thinking more generally, I think a lot of the most valuable experience I got was instruction. So when I was working at Weiwa, providing instruction, providing reference interactions, I'm an IT, I'm the liaison between the IT and the people who use the software. So I do a lot of instruction. We do a ton of workshops. We travel. And when we travel, we also do on-site. I do online instruction. I do in-person. So I think a lot of the sort of hands-on experience I got through, you know, on-the-fly reference work, as well as doing planned instruction is extremely valuable. And I mean, that will carry you across. Pretty much any field that you end up working in. On the specific side, I think a lot of the work I did at Weiwa in thinking about appropriate access, ethical access to materials, ethical appropriate representation of different communities in your collections, also more library-y in your classification and classification schemes and metadata schemes, and how looking at sort of the inherent bias and problematism in a lot of those systems that we work with. I'm glad that I was exposed to that. I wish I'd had probably even a bit more, and I really hope that's something that more people are exposed to in library school. At the Black Lives Matter symposium that we hosted, I mentioned again a little while back, we had a fantastic, and actually all of these sessions are available on our YouTube account. We recorded and broadcast them all. We had one from Burgess Jules, who's an archivist down in California. I can't remember the specific institution. And he was talking very much about the archiving of you know, so I mean, Black Lives Matter archiving protest materials, particularly Twitter. So what, you know, it's important, and we know we want that record at some point, but how can you protect people? Are you endangering people by collecting this information? Yes, it's public, but, you know, what harm is going on around all that?
Yeah. You finish, mm-hmm. and then I've got a question.
No, I was going to say, so I just hope, you know, the ethics of, you know, the modern ethics of archival and library work, I really hope that's something that is at least in some capacity touched on in programs.
Yeah. I mean, I think we were relatively lucky at SLACE in having at least a couple of instructors who saw the value of exposing us to those ideas really
Absolutely.
Early,
yeah.
which was really important. I mean, Lisa Nathan was amazing for me for opening up my eyes on that stuff. I'm curious as to, like, I remember hearing about all of this probably for the first time, especially in the case of Mukherjee, at the 2012 IFLA presidential meeting at UBC. And that was such an amazing experience. And I think within the profession, I think there's probably at this point a consensus that, like, this is the right way to go, that making these things community-led and providing not just access but control over access points and making sure said access is ethical is the right way to do all of these things. But what I wonder is, as a librarian and as that sort of bridge between the communities who own the materials and the researchers and the IT people, do you ever run into situations where you're challenged on this by researchers who want more access or by IT people who don't get why it needs to be built this way? Mm. Or, like, is there that kind of education work embedded in the job too?
Sometimes, not as much as you might think. And I would say that because generally people come to me because they're interested in it.
Mm.
Again, since we maintain the platform and, you know, the software, we don't run sites for people. We have, you know, some that we run ourselves, but we're generally not content providers.
Right. So the researchers wouldn't be coming to you.
Exactly. Mm. The one big site again that we do run is the Plateau Portal. And I haven't really had too much requests about that specifically, from researchers working on that material. And I mean, one of the nice things about Mukherjee specifically is we have a certain degree of security through obscurity. So if there's content which you don't have access to see, you just don't see that it exists.
Right.
Flat out. You have no idea that there is a node of content there. It just, it's not listed for you and you don't see it. So, in that regard, I think a lot of the projects we're working with, that kind of makes it a non-issue to a certain extent. It's not something that I'm presented with myself a lot. I imagine a lot of people do run into that though, who are doing this work. And there's, I mean, the short answer is too bad.
No, completely. Yeah.
This material is not for you. This song is not meant for you to be, is not meant for you to hear. This photo is not for you to see. And I think it's so funny because as soon as you label something as cultural material, people assume that it's, you know, falls under the open information. But everybody has private family material that's, you know, that has cultural significance. So everyone has their own secrets. Everyone has their own private content that you just don't tell to anybody you meet. And I think one reason it's so prevalent with Indigenous content is the persistent representation of Indigenous communities as being dead or dying or in the past, not active, not living, not dynamic, which is incredibly untrue and very, very flawed. So I think that's something that very much feeds into it when we're talking about, you know, very broadly cultural materials, is very often we are talking about Indigenous materials. And so many people just assume that, you know, that's a community that doesn't exist anymore. And in many cases, that's just flat out not the case.
Right. People hear cultural and they assume historical.
Yes. And the portals, again, I keep going back to it, it's a great example. There's a lot of historical materials in it, stuff from our archives, stuff from our university collections. And that's often the first thing that when I talk to community members, from the tribes that they point out. And they're like, well, there's nothing, you know, there's not much modern there. I'm like, well, partly that's because I don't have it to upload, but they're starting to add it. So lots of folks are adding language materials, language work. Some people are doing community documentation projects with it. And sort of going across multiple platforms. So it's a tool that is being used to present the current reality of a lot of communities.
That's great.
It's flexible in that way. There's an accompanying mobile app called Mukidu Mobile. It's an iOS app, which ties into an existing Mukidu site if you have one. Fantastic for kids to work with. It's quite easy to use. So it's great for documenting events if you're at a community gathering or something along those lines. So we're seeing a lot of use in that, which is a great way in to get some of that living information into systems.
Wow.
I just have a more kind of slightly technical question. I just went to Code for Libs, so I kind of have a lot of technical things kind of kicking around in my brain. And I'm just wondering, one of the things that we look at for sites and one of the things that we know how to sort of assign them value is things like usage statistics. Mm-hmm. And I know that when we're using something that's, a platform that is all about this appropriate access to materials and, how do you determine the success of a project like that? And I mean, I know it's also difficult, you know, working with open source software because we don't know exactly who's using it and for what and right. the wherefores. But do you have to provide any education to the communities you work with about that kind of assessment, or are they just not really interested in it?
So sort of two parts to that. One is thinking about the uptake of the software as a whole. I mean, I track all my reference interactions, all my training and support. So we have pretty good documentation of all the training that we provide.
Sure.
So as far as tracking open source usage, yeah, it's tough, but we do a bit of that. This platform specifically, you can connect Google Analytics to it. So if you have an analytics account, you can embed that and collect that statistical information at least. Mm-hmm. So some people some people ask about it, and that's very important. Some people don't. It's not something that I actually tend to do unprompted training around usage and analytics. But thinking about other stuff we do, we do tend to when we do community work, look a fair bit about, what are your outcomes when you're planning a project? So and it doesn't have to be hard numbers necessarily. In many cases, it is. When you start planning anything, what are your outcomes? What are you going to report? What communities are you serving? Who are your users? Who are your patrons? Are you just making content available? Are you attempting to solicit contributions from community members? Because in many cases, these are, community-led projects, so they want to get materials from their community members added to their individual sites. Thinking when you do project planning about reporting an outcome. I mean, that's it is important. And as far as the sort of technical e bit of it, I don't actually focus on that too much, because everybody will need to collect and report that in different ways. Mm-hmm. It's going to vary by. In some cases, web page site views and statistics will be great for reports. But in many cases, just that in-person feedback from somebody who came into your library and said, we've been using this and it's done X, Y, Z, for us. So yeah, not especially satisfying, I guess, but
that gives a sense of how different a project like this can be from, a commercial ebook collection where all you care about is the very stratified numerical statistics.
It's all about them clicks.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say for me, something that's generally going to be more interesting than, again, just the clicks, just the page views is, okay, what percentage of the content has been added by the institution? Again, whether it's us on the portal or on a community site from, what has their archives uploaded and what has been added by community members? Because again, every site could be implemented differently, but there's a number of different ways for community members to interact with the content. Uploading their own material, expanding, annotating, adding to existing metadata records, so on and so forth. So looking at, all right, well, what percentage is institutional, what percentage is community provided, things like that are another way to look at those metrics as well.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you. Like, I think that gives us a real peek inside a project that's very different from things that either of us work on and that from a lot of what our listeners work on. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, unless, like, is there anything you wanted to sort of make sure that as you're talking about the work you're doing that you share about it, especially considering a lot of our listeners tend to be like newish librarians or library students or part-time librarians still kind of exploring what they might want to do?
Sure. a really hard lesson to learn, especially when you start doing community work, is to listen. It's really hard. Mm. And I get this because I present a lot. I do a lot of workshops. I do a lot of community engagement. And sometimes it can be very difficult to listen. And just sit and try to parse out what people are saying, what their needs are. And if you're any community work is driven by community need. A project that is, you know, if we had said within our department or within the library that, you know, we're going to build this plateau portal for our MLU tribes, that would not have been successful. It was a request by the tribal representative saying, this is what we need. These are the resources we need. These are the tools that we need to interact with it. And we listened to that and worked with those requests to make it successful. The software itself came about because of community requests. We have this need and, you know, we want help implementing or developing or finding a way to address that need. The majority of our development, you know, we've added a few features, but the majority of the tools and features that we add to the software as we develop it come from feedback, from the workshops that we do, from the training that we do. And that's a very, you know, it seems like a very specific example, but I would say anyone who's interested in doing any kind of outreach or community engagement, whether that's Indigenous communities or not, you know, if you're thinking about a general public library, whatever your community is, taking that time to do community assessments, to take the feedback and the requests from community members, from community groups, any project that is, you know, sort of that top-down mandate, I think will not be especially successful looking at these development and planning and project planning is far more likely to have community engagement and community adoption further down the road.
That's excellent advice, and I think an absolutely perfect place to say thank you so much again for coming back on the show and telling us about your work. It sounds absolutely fascinating.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me. It was absolutely lovely as always. And I'll just note, if anybody wants to learn more about, I'm sure you can include links as well, but if anybody wants to learn more about it, mukurtu.org, that's M-U-K-U-R-T-U, the R is silent, but mukurtu.org, through there.
I spelled that so wrong in my notes.
I think I always add an extra R sound when I say it.
Yeah, most people do. And I guess I could have mentioned this earlier. The name itself is from the Warmungu community. It's in the Warmungu language, and it translates as Dilly Bag, which is a safekeeping place. Oh. And the name was given to the project by one of the elders, Michael Jambin Jones, one of the community elders. So it's a name that was, again, it was gifted to the project, and we've worked with it since. But yeah, so mukurtu.org is sort of the main contact through there. There's contact to our support line on that site, which will more or less point people to me. and I'm always happy to answer questions. Like, I do online virtual trainings quite regularly. I'm at this point scheduling mostly into the new year, but and also, if anybody wanted to, I mentioned the Black Lives Matter symposium that our department ran, and again, those recordings are all available online. If you get to CDSC, Center for Digital Scholarship and Curation, .libraries.wcu.edu, there should be a link out to our YouTube account that has recordings from that. And for anyone who's interested in, again, in sort of the modern ethics of archival and library work, I highly recommend watching the video, Burgess Jewell's session. It's really a really, really fantastic session. So
thank you.
We'll make sure to add all of those into the notes.
Yes, I'll send those along. I realize links on air is probably not
the it gives people a sense, and then we'll toss them in the notes, and I'm definitely going to go watch that very soon as well. Thank you.
Excellent. I will share all of those things and more with you guys so you can check them out later.
Awesome.
Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
I completely remember that conversation.
Same.
Yeah.
What I do remember is that I always love talking to Michael. I'm so excited he's going to be in town for BCLA.
Oh, yeah. So if you are in one of our, you know, BC librarian cohort, definitely come to, I think he might even be one of the like evening keynote-y type talks.
Oh,
yeah. That's so exciting. So, yeah, make sure that you check him out. He's presenting with Tara Robertson out from Caper at Langara, who's also an amazing person to hear talk about anything.
Michael, Tara, Anita Sarkeesian.
Holy crow.
This is going to be a kick-ass BCLA.
Oh, man. And I'm not volunteering this year.
No, this is going to be the second year for me of just like going this as a be, professional.
It's going to be my first year going just as going as me. It'd be weird.
Freaking out. Free food. Ice cream.
It's not free, dude. We paid like $500 for that ice cream.
Like, if your employer pays for it, then it's free food.
Keys to getting hired, kids. Free food.
So we shall be back in a couple of weeks with another pretty awesome one. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter. You can find us on our website at sslibrarianship.com. I see Canuck Duff got her buttons. Very exciting.
And we also see that apparently Zach Osborne is, we were one of his first podcast subscriptions. And to him, I just have to sincerely say, I'm so sorry that you started with us. That was not
just, like,
good
you
call.
You didn't start with episode
one. Yeah, please tell us you started like with like 80 and you're working your way
you
back.
You do it the Jesse Thorne way. You do the most recent one. You see if you like it. You don't listen to episode one.
That would be a mistake. But no, seriously, thank you so much for subscribing. Of course, it always means a lot.
Mm-hmm. And thank you as well to Jonathan Golden for the use of our theme song, Glasses, off the album Artificial Heart.
Joko Cruz, if you're going this year, I hope you guys have an incredible time.
Hug Sydney for us.
Yes, the McElroys. Two of the many McElroys are going to be there. So yes, that would be nice to meet them. That would be a good
and
reason
on
to
a
go.
Somewhat related to the Cruz note. I just want to shout out to all of my American friends from the Cruz for like fighting the good fight. Right now it's tough times, and I am proud of all of you, and we have got your back up here.
Yep, truly. All right, guys, that's it for us then this week. Or several
fortnight,
whatever. Have fun. We'll just catch you on the proverbial flip side. So much to say, I forget to start. There goes the day as it passes. Forget the pain, let it fall apart. It's okay, I like you in glass. What episode number is it?
I need to check our website.
We're professionals. This is how professionals do things. Professional podcasting from all of us to you.
Ooh, it's 81.
Oh, so it is my turn. I guess I need to take responsibility for this then.
Mm-hmm.
All right then, I guess.